So, Mr. Robertson, next item, please. Can you speak a little closer to the mic?
Went off. Thank you. Moving to item 18. Item 18 is the total maximum daily load for sediment toxicity and pyrethroid pesticides in sediment in the lower Salinas River. For this item, staff will recommend that the Central Coast Water Board approve a resolution that establishes a total max that establishes total maximum daily loads for sediment toxicity and pyrethroid pesticides in sediment in the lower Salinas watershed. Approval of this item would result in amending the basin plan to incorporate these TMDLs and an associated water quality improvement strategy to address toxicity and pyrethroid pesticide impairments in the watershed. Peter Mertens of our TMDL staff will provide a presentation to support this recommendation. And then I'll just add that the board heard a similar TMDL for the Santa Maria River watershed approximately 2 years ago, 2014. Thank you, Jennifer.
Hello, my name is Peter Mertens. I'm an environmental scientist in the TMDL unit. Closer. All right, is that better? All right, thanks. All right, I'm Peter Mertens. I'm an environmental scientist in the TMDL unit. I'm here today with my supervisor, Jennifer Epp, the program, the manager of the TMDL unit, and Lisa McCann, the section manager, is also here. I also have two scientists with UC Davis, Brian Anderson and Bryn Phillips, available for some technical questions. They're behind me. They're available for technical questions on toxicity. They weren't the developers of the UC Davis criteria that was used in the project. That's a separate group at UC Davis, and I'm available for those questions. All right. Here's an outline of my presentation. I'm going to give a little background information on TMDLs. I'm going to describe the impaired waters, provide sources of pollution, targets and TMDLs and allocations, describe the implementation and monitoring, review the public process that we use for the TMDL, and ultimately request your approval of the TMDL and adoption by the board. In general, TMDLs are a Clean Water Act requirement to address impaired waters that are identified on the 303D list. The components I just described in my outline are the components that make up a TMDL and are parts of the TMDL technical project report. As John mentioned initially, the TMDL that we're reviewing today for your approval is similar to the Santa Maria TMDL that was approved in 2014. And many of the components are exactly the same that were approved in 2014 by this board and then also subsequently approved by State Board and adopted by US EPA. They had the same targets. We had similar impairments, similar land uses in the Santa Maria watershed. The TMDLs are the same. Implementation took a similar approach, and the monitoring requirements and public outreach were similar. This is a map of the project area. The project area is the lower Salinas River watershed. It's a drainage area from roughly the city of Gonzales on the south, and it drains north through the city of Salinas towards its outlet in Monterey Bay. For the project there, and hydrologically, there are basically two main sub-watershed areas. We have the main Salinas River channel shown in blue, and in pink is the Tembladero Slough Reclamation Canal drainage area that outlets into Moss Landing. Basis of impairments. Again, as I mentioned, the Federal Clean Water Act is the basis of our water quality goals. Impairments are water bodies not meeting water quality standards or may be threatened in the future. And the water quality standards are in the basin plan and made up of our water quality beneficial uses and the water quality objectives. There are two standards that are used in this TMDL to develop the TMDL and address the impairments. One is for toxicity. It states that all water shall be maintained free of toxic substances in concentrations which are toxic to or which produce detrimental physiological responses in human, plant, animal, or aquatic life. The second objective is for pesticides. No individual pesticide or combination of pesticides shall reach concentrations that adversely affect beneficial uses. Sediment toxicity is evaluated using a standard EPA test method and test organism. The organism is an amphipod, Hyalella azteca. Hyalella is a species found in streams widely and abundantly throughout North America. It's a crustacean about a quarter inch long and is found commonly in our watersheds. This slide summarizes 11 years of sediment toxicity data in the Lower Salinas River watershed. It was collected from 2004 to 2013. So I'll give an example. This is Alisal Creek monitoring data. There were three samples collected for Alisal Creek, and of those three samples, two of them were toxic. Overall, at the bottom here, we have had 159 samples collected in the watershed, and out of those 159, 111 indicated there was sediment toxicity. Sediment toxicity tends to focus in drainages with higher sediment deposition. So you'll notice on this slide areas such as the Old Salinas River Channel, the Reclamation Canal, tend to have higher ratios of toxic samples to the total samples. And areas like the Salinas River with greater flows have lower toxicity. And areas with tile drains such as Blanco Drain and Alisal Slough also tend to have less sediment deposition due to the tile drains and lower sediment toxicity. The TMDL also addresses pyrethroid pesticide impairments in the watershed based on concentrations of pyrethroids in sediments and toxicity unit analysis. Water bodies were identified as impaired for pyrethroids. In addition to the TMDL toxicity unit analysis, several watershed and statewide studies link pyrethroids to sediment toxicity. Three specific studies and two broader statewide studies are included in the TMDL. The watershed studies found both urban and agricultural sources of pyrethroids. The studies considered other pesticides as sources of toxicity, but linked sediment toxicity primarily to pyrethroid pesticides. The statewide studies found pyrethroids and sediment toxicity to be a widespread urban pollution problem. The TMDL identifies sources of pollution. Urban and agricultural applications of pyrethroids are the sources of pyrethroids in surface waters and sediment toxicity. Pyrethroids are common home and garden insecticides and are used on major crops in the watershed, such as lettuce, broccoli, and strawberries. So for the TMDL source analysis, I also did sub-watershed source analysis. I evaluated pesticide use and sediment concentration toxicity units in a small agricultural watershed and link pyrethroid applications to specific uses of pyrethroids on crops. Department of Pesticide Regulation pesticide use data was used to evaluate specific crop sources in the Alisal Creek watershed, which is just east of the city of Salinas. It is an agricultural watershed only, primarily. The Alisal Creek was sampled in May 2010, and what I have here are the toxicity levels that were identified at the time. So for bifenthrin, for example, 1.79 toxic units were identified in the water sample located here at the base of the watershed. And toxicity units greater than 1 indicate an exceedance of the targets. I also used this data set to evaluate and illustrate toxicity and persistence of pyrethroids. So, for example, we, again, as I mentioned, there was a sample in, collected in May 2010 when we had an exceedance. And looking at pesticide use report data for the periods around that sample, so I summarized pesticide use data for two years. And for 6 months prior, there were no applications of bifenthrin in this instance in that watershed. Also, pyrethroids tend to be, and on the agricultural side, somewhat crop-specific, and they were only applied to strawberries in this watershed, and strawberries generally, in the once established, are irrigated on drip, and there's little runoff. So it's a challenge to identify specific sources and transport mechanisms, although we know it's a strawberry. So in summary, pyrethroids are used in upland areas, on farms, and in cities to control insect pests. They are transported attached to sediment and organic particles, and that's what this demonstrates here, in runoff, and deposited in streams. In streams, they partition between sediment and the dissolve phase in the water column. And it is this freely dissolved fraction that is associated with toxicity to Hylella, the test organism. For the TMDL, water quality numeric targets were developed to ascertain when and where narrative water quality objectives were achieved, and hence when beneficial uses are protected. The targets provide numeric indicator that represents when the narrative toxicity and narrative pesticide objectives are achieved. The TMDL has targets for sediment toxicity and pyrethroids. The sediment toxicity target is a numeric interpretation of the basin plan's narrative water quality objective for toxicity and is based on using the test organism and tests for Hylella azteca in sediment. The pyrethroid pesticide targets are numeric interpretations of the narrative objective for pesticides. The TMDL has two targets for pyrethroids. One is in sediment, and since pyrethroids partition between sediment and water, one for pyrethroids in water. The water column numeric targets are based on water quality criteria developed by UC Davis. The pyrethroid sediment toxicity target is based on pyrethroid toxicity unit analysis using concentrations of pyrethroids in sediment compared to known published median lethal concentrations. PMDLs are the amount of pollutants that can be received in a surface water without exceeding water quality objectives for toxicity and pesticides. The sediment toxicity TMDL is equal to the sediment toxicity numeric target, and the pyrethroids in sediment TMDL is equal to the pyrethroid sediment concentration toxicity unit targets. Both TMDLs are allocated to municipalities and to irrigated agricultural operations in the watershed. For implementation, The TMDL takes an interagency approach working with Department of Pesticide Regulations to comprehensively address sediment toxicity and pyrethroid pesticide water quality problems. Since pesticides and water quality are regulated differently for municipalities and agriculture, the TMDL has separate plans for each. The interagency approach is based on a management agency agreement signed between the water boards and Department of Pesticide Regulations to assure that pesticides are used in a manner that protects water quality. The California Pesticide Management Plan and response processes are components of the management agency agreement. Together, they outline a cooperative approach between the agencies to address impairments in this TMDL. To address impairments in this TMDL, we initiate the response process by notifying Department of Pesticide Regulations, and they responded their willingness to coordinate on the response with us. The City of Salinas and the County of Monterey are the two municipalities in the watershed that receive allocations and must develop waste load allocation attainment plans. Urban stormwater pesticide problems are not unique to the municipalities, however, but are problems faced by municipalities throughout the state. And the TMDL takes a statewide approach as part of that implementation recommendation. In 2012, DPR, Department of Pesticide Regulations, approved urban pesticide surface water protection regulations that place restrictions on professional applications of pyrethroids in urban areas. The regulations apply to professional applicators such as gardeners and pest control businesses. Within the water boards, State Board has recently launched a process to establish a statewide framework for urban pesticide implementation. Irrigated agricultural implementation relies on requirements in the agricultural order. The agricultural order requires compliance with water quality standards, and growers must implement management practices to effectively control discharge. The agricultural order requires growers to develop farm plans, implement management practices, report on management practice implementation through annual compliance forms, and adapt practices with the iterative process to show water quality improvements over time. The TMDL also makes additional recommendations to achieve the TMDL. Some of those include ranch-specific farm plans for pyrethroid pesticide implementation. In addition, the TMDL places emphasis on US EPA regulations for implementation. In 2008, US EPA placed label requirements for buffers to protect aquatic habitat from pyrethroid runoff, and the TMDL recommends assuring that these requirements are met. The TMDL relies on existing programs for monitoring water quality. This is a list of the programs that are currently being implemented in the watershed. These programs extensively monitor the watershed. However, in the TMDL, we make some additional recommendations for added sediment, chemistry monitoring for pyrethroids. Currently, the agricultural order monitors once during the five-year cycle, and we recommend annual monitoring of pyrethroids. The TMDL also recommends extending the monitoring into the fall period for some surface waters that have perennial flows and high deposition of sediments throughout the year. As part of the TMDL development, we develop a time schedule for the project. The current, and this slide outlines that our time schedule. At the current level, we already have implementation ongoing through Department of Pesticide Regulations in the urban area. In 3 years, we anticipate development of an agricultural implementation program specific for pyrethroids we recommend some additional time for implementation over the urban area because there's some need for agricultural BMP development and implementation of programs. Within 5 years, we anticipate municipal allocations being achieved, and for agriculture, we anticipate achievement in 10 years. In 15 years, targets should be achieved in receiving waters, also as indicators of meeting the TMDLs. During the development of the TMDL, we had several public meetings. We started the project in January 2015 with a kickoff meeting, and at that point, we introduced the water quality problems, the impairments, and described the project area. Following in March 2015, we had a CEQA scoping meeting where we discussed sources of impairment, discussed management practices, and the potential impacts that we need to analyze for in the CEQA process. Shortly thereafter, the Grower Shipper Association invited us, me to give a talk to their water committee, and we had a very constructive meeting at the Grower Shipper office and discussed the TMDL in great detail. Then the following December, we had another public meeting where we explained the targets, TMDLs, and allocations, and went into more detail about implementation and timelines. And then this January, we made our documents, draft documents for this project available to the public, and we started a 45-day public comment period. And then we collected those after the 45 days. In early March, wanted to mention that, or actually late March, we had I attended a UC Cooperative Extension workshop where I gave a presentation on the TMDL. The workshop was organized by UC Cooperative Extension specifically on the concerns of pyrethroids and their future and the impacts to water quality. And we had a very good discussion and forum with UC Extension. We also had speakers from Department of Pesticide Regulations, the County Agricultural Commissioner, and we had a nice forum afterwards where growers and pest control advisors were able to, where I was able to engage with them directly and talk and find out what their concerns were about the project. So public comments and staff responses. This is, I think, one of the most valuable aspects of this TMDL process. We've had very good engagement with, I feel like, with the public and with stakeholders. We had six comment letters on the draft documents, and I reviewed them and wrote responses to the comments. I would, also wanted to add that I think based on the engagement, we had comments at a very, very high technical level, and also with a very good understanding of the TMDL process. So I think we had, comments that were very valuable. It's kind of hard to condense 50 pages of comments and responses into one slide. So I kind of pulled out a few key areas and thought I'd give you, a little overview of some of their comments. One of the areas of concern is the UC Davis criteria. It's very low. So there's concerns about the low criteria. There are concerns that it's in water column. Since we're addressing sediment toxicity impairments that were initially identified on the 303D list. We have comments concerning monitoring, adding additional monitoring the water column, also why we're recommending fall monitoring in some watersheds. So there were questions and concerns about the implementation of the TMDL. They're on very, I guess, hands-on level, how do growers actually put in the BMPs and what specific ones are needed, and some of the concerns and difficulties. I mean, there's research on different BMPs, but when it comes down to on-the-ground implementation, how is the grower going to implement them, and some practical aspects that they mentioned that need to be worked out. And then importance of pyrethroids. I think some of this was expressed in the public comment letters. We also received, you received a letter a little bit late because the pest control advisors that we spoke to wanted to organize a letter with the Grower Shipper Association, and I think that outlines a lot of the importance of pyrethroids in as for protecting the commodities here in the Salinas Valley and the importance for those crops. And there's a lot of technical aspects that the pest control advisors go into their decision-making to choose pesticides, and that was really well conveyed in that workshop and in their letter. Also, there's some safety issues with different pesticides and alternatives. There's limits to how many new materials come on the market and other pesticides that are available if they don't have pyrethroids. So, and some of those have greater risks to human health, more acute toxicity and potential risks to workers. So, so some of those were brought to light in the process. Okay, so that basically concludes my technical portion of the TMDL. We have one minor edit that we need to disclose. EPA last Wednesday called with some comments and sent an email request to make a minor edit and clarification, and we're presenting that so for disclosure that that edit would be made in the documents. And it's to an attachment one, and it's on page 14 of 17 and on the allocation table to clarify that the allocations equal the TMDLs. So finally, I this is my last slide. You know, the staff recommendation is to adopt this resolution as proposed, including the EPA edit, and to approve the TMDLs, total maximum daily loads for sediment toxicity and pyrethroids in sediment in the lower Salinas River watershed.
Thank you, Mr. Mertens. I think before we start questions from board members, this is a perfect time to take a break, and I would like us to reconvene at 11 o'clock. Thank you. Okay, so I would like now to offer my fellow board members the opportunity to ask questions. I do have also a fair amount of speaker cards, so what we're going to do is field questions, direct questions to our staff. I'll see what time it will be, and then either we'll start public comments, you know, before or after we take a lunch break. So we'll play that by ear. But I'm looking at my left. I'll start on no question. Mr. Johnson?
I have questions. And I did my questions kind of in order as you went through your slides. And so kind of starting at the top, just things that I didn't quite understand. You had a sediment toxicity sampling slide that gave a bunch of watersheds. Can we put that up? A bunch of water bodies. Probably was about your sixth or seventh slide.
And while we do that, speaker cards for these items are closed now since we have entered into this agenda item.
I see it. It's just to the left of your arrow as I look at my screen. Got it. Okay, so you're showing 111 out of 159 samples are toxic. But I guess my question is, now, are these sediment samples or water column samples?
These are sediment samples.
Okay. And was the organism used, the one that we're talking about here, the, you gave the Latin name, quarter inch long, because I saw some stuff in the comments about two different organisms.
Yes, it's the Hialeah Azteca.
Okay, it's Hialeah Azteca. If I say that six more times, I'll know it. And what does it mean when we say that it was toxic?
It was based on survival.
So does it mean half of them survived, or the statistical amount that you would expect to survived if there was not toxicity present?
It's hard to give just a straight number that survived. It's a comparison to a control group, and based on a statistical analysis.
Okay, so it's not like 50%. It's what you would expect if there were no toxicity present, essentially. The control group is no toxicity.
Yeah, you have the two groups, and then you compare the numbers that after, say, 10 days between
Got
the
it.
Two groups.
Okay. And now, moving down, it might have even been the next slide. There was a slide on Alisal Creek and the different There was a slide on there we go. Okay, so you're talking about in that sub-watershed, I assume that's at one sampling location in May 2010, you're getting between 1.79 and 2.2 toxicity units of these different pesticides. So, and these are all different pyrethroid pesticides. So is the standard we're talking about here additive, that this would add up to something like about 7 or 7.5 toxicity units total?
Yes.
Okay, so the standard were the...
Yeah, it's the target.
One toxicity unit is the maximum we're trying to... The target we're trying to be under, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and this is actually not reflective of like somewhere in the range of 2. This is reflective of somewhere in the range of 7.5.
Yes.
Okay, that's helpful. Now, you talked in your presentation about recommendations for the future ag waiver, and I understand that adopting the TMDL doesn't adopt those recommendations. That's going to be a whole separate process. But the recommendation for annual monitoring, are we talking about explain that a little bit? Are we talking about annual monitoring of at sites that were – is that like annual monitoring in receiving waters? Is that annual monitoring on every farm? Or what are we talking about when you say there's a recommendation for annual monitoring?
Yeah, what we recommend is to – we have – the agricultural order has existing, it's roughly spring monitoring of sediment toxicity as part of the monitoring reporting program, and we're recommending that every year coinciding with that, they do specific sediment chemistry for pyrethroid pesticides.
And that monitoring is part of our surface water monitoring program? That's not something that's done on every ranch, is it?
No, it's an ambient monitoring, so we have sites throughout the lower watershed.
Okay, I know what we're talking about now. And finally, can you talk a little bit? You referenced as one of the frequent comments problems with alternatives, and I realize that's not necessarily something that can bar us from taking an action to deal with a problem, but I'm just curious to hear just a little bit about that.
Okay. I can give an example of the discussion that we had at the UC Cooperative Extension Workshop, and they specifically asked the group of pest control advisors what their alternatives would be, and they discussed the pests that they're treating for and what was their primary pesticide, and then what would be alternatives if the pyrethroid wasn't available. So one of the materials has the trade name lanate, and that's a carbamate classification of insecticide. And it's has a much higher acute toxicity to a person applying it. So that's like a dermal toxicity. You know, when workers go out and apply materials, the pyrethroids are at a much lower threshold. I mean, I don't know all the terminology for risk when you're applying pesticides, but they're clearly on the label, and the labels are significantly different in terms of that risk. And so that would be a material that would be an alternative that is used already, but if the use would, you know, it would need to be used more frequently. So.
All right. That's the only questions I have. I just want to that was a very useful and clear presentation, and I want to say I particularly like the way you summarized the comments at the end without editorializing. I struggled through those 50 pages of comments last night and this morning, and I thought your summary was a good distillation, you know, without all the detail, and I particularly appreciated that you didn't try to answer them all. You just tried to put them out there. Thank you.
Mayor Delgado.
Thank you. I'll just say I'm extremely impressed by the competency that I detect has been put into this by staff, and that has taken a long time to compile everything that you've summarized for us today. So thank you for such a good job well done. Can you explain, and I see it in the comments from public and the responses by staff in attachment 4, but can you summarize an explanation of why you're proposing the annual monitoring compared to the existing ag order's 5-year requirement monitoring cycle?
Well, actually, the slide that I have up kind of helps with that. There's often kind of signals with pyrethroids in the water, and they have they're used on specific crops. So in terms of implementation, I think it's valuable feedback to know what the specific chemicals we're detecting so that then you can move back up into the watershed and start analyzing the practices and look at the decisions that are being made and the specific crops often follow a particular pesticide or particular pyrethroid. So I think that's valuable on an annual level to have that feedback.
Okay. When the ag order was drafted, there were a couple of pesticides particularly addressed. Now we're addressing a different group. Is it just kind of a bouncing ball that every few years there's going to be a new pesticide group or pesticide that we're specifically addressing?
Well, I think historically your characterization's correct. You know, that has been the pattern. We've moved from like organochlorine to organophosphate to pyrethroid pesticides, and as you know, the new materials on the urban side, the up and coming one that is being detected is fipronil, and that's commonly used in the urban areas to control pests and used on pets and stuff like that. And now we're detecting it in our surface waters. So, yes, it's that's the. That's what often happens.
Okay. And that's because we can't predict what the replacements are going to be in every case. And once those replacements start to be implemented, we see their effects, and then we want to address those effects.
Yes, I would. That's been the traditional path. I think that there's a much greater awareness of this cycle. And the efforts, we work closely with the Surface Water Monitoring Program at Department of Pesticide Regulations, and they're developing models so that if you look at the characteristics of the pesticides we're detecting and then a new pesticide comes along, you can run those through the models and evaluate if we're going to have the same problems. So I think there's a shift in mindset on pesticide registration and management. Particularly on the urban side, there are active groups that are communicating more closely as materials become registered.
I also want to just add that TMDLs themselves are reactive. They only address already known impairments, so they're not necessarily used to address what could be a future impairment, since we don't already know it? It's based on the science that's already there of impairments.
Okay.
And if I may add, excuse me, if I may add as well, you know, this issue of what are people going to switch to comes up, and obviously that is a concern. But I want to make it clear that from the Water Board's perspective, we're not telling people they should stop using a particular pesticide and they should use another particular pesticide. What we're interested in is the bottom line, the actual toxicity in the receiving water. And so there's two ways to react to this TMDL. You could stop using the pyrethroids, or you could figure out how to use the pyrethroids in a way that doesn't cause the toxicity that we're seeing. And so we're not specifying which direction that goes, and we're not advocating for people to stop using pyrethroids. We're looking to control the bottom end of the problem, which is figuring out how to decrease the toxicity in the receiving waters.
Jennifer, can you state your name for the record?
This is Jennifer Upp.
Thank you.
Okay, I wanted to direct everyone's attention to page 11 and 12 of the staff report, where I had some discussion with staff about this. And these sections on page 11 and page 12 are repeated verbatim in the proposed TMDL in the attachment 1. And if you go to the middle of the page of number 11, page 11, you'll see four enumerated compliance measures. One, attaining the load allocations and receiving water. Two, attaining numeric targets. And three, that I want to bring to everyone's attention, is implementing management practices that are capable of achieving interim and final load allocations identified in the TMDL. And if you look above those four, the introductory sentence says that compliance will be assessed using one or a combination of those following four. And it's my interpretation that when you say one or a combination of the following would be used to assess compliance, that if I was a grower, I would say, hey, I'm compliant with number one, or I'm compliant with number X. Therefore, I think staff should, the Water Board should find me compliant. But if you were just to look at number three, because you were implementing management practices capable of achieving, it'd almost be like you were a classroom student saying, I'm doing all the homework and study habits I should be, which are capable of getting an A, so I want you to assess my performance at the A level, even though I'm a C or D student. And similarly, on the next page, page 12, when it comes to MS4, you know, the stormwater dischargers, there is a MS4 entities may be deemed in compliance through implementation of projects capable of achieving interim and final waste allocations. So given that, I mean, I kind of see that as a loophole, or as a, at least as a confusing piece of language. And when you go to pages 15 and 17 of the 17-page attachment 1, page 15 of 17 and 17 of 17, it's verbatim in there. And so my question to staff, as it was that I posed to them during my conversations earlier, last week I think it was, that if we just deleted the four words in the introductory sentence to each of those two paragraphs, to delete the words one of a combination, so that it would just read that compliance would be assessed using the following rather than one or a combination, just to reduce or eliminate what I think of as an ambiguous wording. So I wanted to ask staff again, if you thought deleting those four words would reduce confusion and still allow staff to implement the TMDL sufficiently.
So the language that's in both the staff report as well as in the Basin Plan Amendment that you're referring to really is information to tell people how staff might assess compliance. The language that's in here doesn't tie staff's hand. So having the language in there, we don't feel like someone could say, oh, well, there is a loophole. I'm okay because I've met item number three, even though my BMPs aren't actually working. So the language isn't similar to when you'd actually have something in a permit and it would list how a person is in compliance. This is basically just telling people how staff might look at things and evaluate compliance. So we're comfortable with the language as it is. We're also comfortable with removing the one or a combination of the following if that's the purview of the board. We think either one of those would work and not cause problems.
I remember that you mentioned that to me when we spoke, and that's kind of my point, is that this is the communication piece of this to the layperson, and that's where the confusion lies. If I was being regulated, I would read this differently than how you've described it, that it doesn't tie your hands. I would say, well, it, you know, anyway, I won't repeat myself, but thank you for that.
And I think conceptually the reason why we have that perspective is that the people are going to be regulated through the regulatory mechanisms. So they're going to be regulated through the language that's in the agricultural order, that's in the stormwater permits. And so that's really what is the most important when you look at someone's compliance, is what's in those implementing mechanisms.
Okay. And I think a backstop is on page 13, table 8, where it shows, and you showed it in your PowerPoint as well, the timetable for achieving the TMDLs, where you have 3, 5, 10, and 15-year milestones. Is it your opinion that the four assessment pieces that I just brought up are sort of a narrative guide of how you'll be considering compliance over the next many years, but it's these milestones that are more tangible ways to assess compliance?
Okay. I think these are the TMDL is a planning document. These are the milestones that we estimate and their recommendations. So they provide some guidance for the programs moving forward. But again, like as Jennifer's mentioned, the permits and the numbers that go end up in permits and orders are the stronger language. So, but it does provide guidance towards the future. Does that help?
Yeah, and I guess I misunderstood. I thought they were firmer, but it's really just guidance milestones. They're not used to evaluate compliance necessarily.
Yeah, I think they're estimates of, again, on the technical standpoint, I tried to, through the technical report, go through in a process, evaluate models, look at the fate and transport of the pollutants, look at the status of implementation, and put together those pieces. It's a complicated thing to come up with budgets and timelines, and tried to put some rigor into that. But again, I would call them estimates.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Ms. Gray?
Sorry, I have a comment and then a small question, and it's somewhat related. So thank you again for your great presentation, and I want to commend you on the overall efforts. You've put a lot of work into this, and certainly the outreach was reflected very well in the staff report. So I read recently that overall in the state of California, I think for the second or third year in a row, that pesticide usage has been reduced 3-6%. And so I was wondering, so I remain hopeful that we won't have to continue to do these TMDLs, but I'm sure, as noted, we have to be reactive. Are we tracking any of that locally on the Central Coast with our local ag commissioner's offices?
They do, yes. I mean, pesticide use reporting is one of the most rigorous processes and requirements.
Right. No, I meant as our office.
Oh, is our office.
Yeah. Are we sort of working with any of the Ag Commissioner's Office on the Central Coast?
Yes. Yeah.
Level?
We definitely are working closely with them and working with them on these problems. They do the tracking and compile the numbers, we periodically evaluate the use. Mainly we do it for projects that come along, such as TMDLs, but we're also, we do look at that regularly for implementation and to know where we have water quality problems.
Lisa McCann, section manager with the Water Board. Karen Wooster, our regional monitoring coordinator, brings the change in use and the use data from the DPR database into our Healthy Watersheds Assessment Report Card. That application isn't yet integrated and available to find online publicly, but the system is set up to have that be an indicator, the changes in that to be an indicator in our assessment of healthy watersheds.
You know, and I'd also want to add that we developed TMDL technical report cards as follow-ups for the TMDL and some of that information, I believe, is being incorporated into that as we evaluate past use.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you, both, actually all staff, because I know these programs and processes take a lot of effort on our staff part. But thank you, Peter, for your very informative presentation, staff report. Everything was very helpful, very technical issues we're dealing with. But I want to talk a little bit about two things. One, the monitoring programs. And you mentioned, I believe, six programs, including one that we reviewed yesterday, the City of Salinas Stormwater Permit, the Ag Order Swamp, the Swamp Program, the Stream Pollution Trends Monitoring Program, CCAMP, and then DPR, which you just were talking more, gave more details about how DPR data is used and integrated with what we're doing. But we also learned yesterday that the stormwater permit is the vehicle or the tool for implementing the TMDL, the current order, as it appears, is not designed to monitor the, in particular, pyrethroid pesticides, correct?
Okay, I'm not fully up to speed, but I believe it is, yes. I, when I reviewed it, I thought that it was fairly adequate to address the water quality problems that we're addressing. A lot of the pyrethroid problems were prevalent a while back when they were developing the stormwater permits, and they have it appeared to me a very rigorous monitoring program, and I didn't see the need for greater maybe coordination with the other programs like the agricultural programs, but that they had fairly rigorous monitoring.
Yeah, and I get, okay, so just so I'm understanding, so the data that they're currently collecting within their monitoring program, which we heard has gaps in it and is going to be looked at more carefully, and they're going to make some efforts to fill in some gaps and questions that they've already discovered. But what you're saying is the monitoring programs that you refer to are already capturing specifically pyrethroid data. So wherever it's showing up.
Well, yes. I mean, some of the programs, like Department of Pesticide Regulations, is they are monitoring annually, collecting samples through the summer months in the Lower Salinas watershed. So that's a data set that, you know, dischargers aren't going to have to pay for, and is they should leverage and analyze and evaluate.
Dr. Hunter, this is Jennifer. If I may add, you specifically asked about the City of Salinas. Well, the City of Salinas, after adoption of this TMDL, will be required to develop a waste load allocation attainment plan, the WAP, and that plan will identify whether or not they need to do additional monitoring or whether or not their current monitoring is in place. So really that'll be the opportunity once a TMDL is adopted for the city to look at their current program and say, hey, do we already have the answers based on what we're currently doing, or do we need to do something different in order to evaluate this TMDL moving forward?
Oh, good. That's what I was trying to understand, because there was some discussion about how the new order coming up in the next year, 2017, how that would reflect this new TMDL. Lisa, did you want to add something?
Yeah, just briefly. Neither Jennifer nor Peter were here yesterday and aren't necessarily required to be the experts on what the Salinas permit contains, although Peter does have some familiarity from his work. As we talked about yesterday, I just want to clarify the gaps, City of Salinas representatives can clarify if I get this wrong. The gaps that they were speaking about yesterday and that we're talking about coordinating and making adding or filling with the new Salinas stormwater permit are not receiving water monitoring stations or constituents necessarily. There may or may not be some need to improve that coordination as well, but the main gaps are related to the within the city and evaluation of effectiveness of their practices to control the pollution in their runoff.
Well, yeah, but aren't we saying that the urban contribution of pyrethroids is going to be something we see through the stormwater permits? That's what I thought I heard yesterday.
In receiving water, we will have indications of that will come through multiple parties permitting. Our ambient monitoring program, potentially the cooperative monitoring program for the ag order, as well as DPR, because the locations of some of that, the samples in the receiving water are near where outfalls are from the city of Salinas, and their contribution enters the receiving waters.
Right.
And specific clarification of their contribution and whether it's being reduced will be realized through the monitoring in the Salinas stormwater permit.
Yeah, thank you. That's what I was trying to get to. So when we look at this suite of six different monitoring programs, then what you're telling us is that there's, because of the TMDL, there will be this additional or heightened effort at coordinating to better collaborate and using the data that we have, the existing data we have, and then strengthening or enhancing the criteria or the way the monitoring programs are designed to extend them seasonally, because now we're looking at pyrethroids in cyclic fashion, and we're seeing that there are spikes at different times of the year that we may not be capturing currently. Is that what I... Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, I think you're characterizing it correctly, yes.
Okay, perfect. Well, good. Okay, because I'm all about maximizing what we know and using data sets and integration of data sets and eliminating redundancy, because I think what I heard yesterday and what we've heard often is the cost of monitoring is really a big challenge for across the board with our stakeholders and the regulated community. So I'm glad to see that staff, and I've heard this before, this is not the first time you've come forward with a new TMDL where we understand that the monitoring, you know, is going to start to reflect a need for more clarity in what we're seeing, what we suspect, and how we can confirm and validate what we know. So I would encourage you to continue your dialogues with the stakeholders. And Peter, I appreciate you reflecting on the meetings that you had and the type of interaction that you engaged in, because I think that kind of on the ground dialogue is essential to understanding the implications and, you know, what people's response is and how they move forward. And so that leads to my next question. On page 13 of the staff report, it's just the timeline, which was also in your PowerPoint. And I noted, and we talked about the idea that the urban uses are already under new rules as related to commercial application, the ag order and the ag users are going to require some additional time. So that to me, that is a reasonable idea that we would give them a framework in which to move forward. But I was curious that includes voluntary actions both by individuals in looking at their own farm practices, ranch practices, as well as regional approach. So I'm interested in knowing what was the response. There, I think on page 10, is it 10? Yes, page 10, you have the voluntary actions. A few of those deal with regional approaches. And I was curious if you could characterize at this point, Jen or Peter, what is the response, or is there much discussion so far about taking a regional approach at sub-watershed level or in other ways, a collaborative response or plan for action?
Well, I think a lot of the discussion we've had in Salinas has been focused on farm practices and implementing BMPs on the farm level. I want to add, though, that if I could use the Santa Maria TMDL as an example, that subsequent to its adoption, we've had several initiatives to work on regional treatment. So you might be familiar with a bioreactor grant that's occurring on the Bradley Channel watershed. So that has an opportunity. We're coordinating with the UC Davis folks and that do the monitoring and the Department of Pesticide Regulations to evaluate if the bioreactor would be an effective treatment mechanism for pesticides as well. So DPR wrote a study protocol, and we're evaluating also a bioreactor that we built in the lower Oso Flaco watershed to see what's the pesticide removal rate from a surface water that's run through the bioreactor. And we're also looking into projects in elsewhere in the Santa Maria watershed. And by approving the TMDL, we have a project in the lower Oso Flaco watershed to do a design and evaluation for treatment of Oso Flaco Lake. So I think the grant opportunities come about after the TMDL gets adopted, and then groups can work regionally on projects. In the Salinas watershed, our grant coordinator has also been in contact with Department of Pesticide Regulations to look at projects that are being implemented, like bioreactors in the lower Salinas area. I think it's Ocean Mist Farms has one, and they've been in discussion about that project and how that might be, projects like that could be used regionally. So I think there's been good discussion about that.
Sorry about that. That brings up the issue of grants. I really appreciate you pointing that out. So are these state-funded programs that are providing this pilot exploration, or I don't know if they're pilots. Bioreactors are probably proven, but...
Yeah, yes, so we have a mix of funds going into that, and I'm not sure if all the specifics. I work right next door to the grant coordinator, so I should know the specific project and the propositions that fund them. But we have state funds, we have EPA funds going into projects, and we also have Department of Pesticide Regulations funding projects directly also. So they have funds available, and they fund research too. So.
Okay. Lisa?
Lisa McCannigan. I just wanted to add that it may be just a rumor at this point, but we heard recently from stakeholders that in the lower Salinas River, some growers are developing a proposal that we're going to see soon. And if Harvey Packer's in the room and has more info, he can offer it. And maybe one of the ag reps that's here, if it's ripe for them to talk about, can say more about that or validate that if that's so or not. But it's a very positive sign in response to your question.
Oh, thank you. Okay. All right, well, I'll let it go there. Thank you.
Mr. Young.
Thank you. Would also like to commend staff on a very comprehensive and thorough presentation. I especially found very informative all of the public comments and then staff's responses to them. I read through all the 50 pages and... it kind of helps to validate the questions that I might have and then others that I never even thought about. But I do find, staff's responses, most of the time very, what's the word I want to use? I think on target in a complete response. Sometimes... I think the responses show kind of the state of the art of what we're trying to do, with a program like this. But that's not a comment attributing any fault, to what's being done. I think this is a pretty complex thing to try to control through, regulations, and this is the best vehicle we have to do it. Has the Santa Maria TMDL been petitioned? I'm just curious.
Yes, it was petitioned. The state board dismissed it, and it is now in litigation.
So a lawsuit has been filed?
Yes.
Okay. Has the Department of Pesticide Regulation or Department of Food and Ag commented on this TMDL? Because I don't see anything specifically in here.
Oh, well, there's an attachment at the end. We submitted the document to them, and they did a brief review, but not a thorough evaluation of the TMDL. They reviewed it. They were familiar with it. They didn't provide detailed written comments on the TMDL.
Okay. Somehow I missed that. I mean, page 16 of the staff report tells me where comments were received. And the bottom of 15 onto the top of 16, you know, does let me know that Caltrans, you know, was involved in this process. I just didn't see DPR mentioned. Was that in some other document?
Well, there's an attachment at the end, and that we engaged them in this management agency agreement response process.
Okay.
By sending them a letter from our executive officer to the director of DPR, and then then we have a response letter back where they acknowledge our letter, acknowledge the water, you know, reviewing the water quality data, that they will do that, and their willingness to move forward with a collaborative process similar to one that we initiated when we were working on chlorpyrifos water quality problems. So, and that's the informal, we've developed like an informal work group with them. So we do work very closely with them. I'm the agency coordinator with Department of Pesticide Regulations, and we have several projects, and also UC Davis is involved in a group with us working on problems.
Peter, that sounds like they haven't actually commented in substance as to
the attachment 7.
Right.
On 18.
Okay.
They're the last documents in the packet.
And this is Jennifer Epp. If you just read attachment 7, it might appear that we didn't have any conversations with the Department of Pesticide Regulations until the very end of the process. But as Peter alluded to, he's involved with them and engages with them on a very regular basis on all of these issues through that management agency agreement. And the reason why they're not in the response to public comments is really it's an agency-to-agency discussion, and we, through that collaboration, keep them engaged in things along the way, and they get to see things and get to know what's going on throughout the process.
Okay. So it looks like this is a very generalized response that we're going to cooperate in evaluating data moving forward and things of that nature, but nothing of substance that would have made you change anything in the TMDL.
Yes, I think that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Saw a comment in, I think it was Tessa's letter, not Tessa's, pardon me, in Abby's letter, about in soliciting and including all data. And I'm not sure what the response was to that or whether there is data that was not included in this analysis.
Okay. Well, there's maybe a couple. You were mentioning two people that could have
I don't think it was Tess.
Okay.
I think it was Abby's letter.
Yes. Well, Tess has concerns in her comments regarding the listing process. So, and there's concerns that she will probably bring up. She brought up in her letter regarding adding water bodies to our assessment.
And that's not what I'm referring to.
Oh, okay.
I'm referring to what was in Abby's letter about data.
Okay.
Not included.
Well,
in the evaluation.
Yeah, there are probably data sets more current than, you know, I used data through 2013 and we're, you know, now 2016. So there would be additional agricultural program monitoring data that's been submitted to CCAMP and SWAMP that I, you know, didn't have available in the data sets that I was working with. So I use up to 2013 sediment toxicity data.
When was that data submitted into CCAMP?
You know, I don't have the specific details on those dates. Also, in the response to comments, I did go through and look at specific reports from the the cooperative monitoring program to evaluate just kind of in a more cursory way current, you know, some of their current findings, and, you know, there was still toxicity present in these water bodies. So.
Okay. So in terms of the urban stormwater permits, we've got, I see mention of the Monterey County. I see mention of Salinas. With Monterey County, that's a phase two?
Yes.
Okay. And does that stormwater permit have a component dealing with pesticides?
Well, again,
at this point in time?
Oh, go ahead.
I can speak to that. Yeah, they're phase two, so they're enrolled in the statewide general stormwater permit. And it doesn't specifically call out targeted pesticides, but it does require prioritization of water quality problems and implementing management practices in response to that and reducing load, and still allows us to amend the TMDL requirements in terms of once a TMDL is adopted, that if it says you have to do a wasteland allocation plan or you have to do specific monitoring associated with the TMDL to make that a requirement for the individual permittee.
So I started to try to visualize the overlap here between the ag order and then the two stormwater permits. Have you guys put together some kind of an overlaying map that brings to light who is being, you know, regulated by this? And by that I mean, that's very vague, I know. I look at, you know, that one, the sub-basin Alisol, if you want to put that up. I assume that doesn't involve the city of Salinas.
Right.
That
so
particular one.
I only hesitated because I'm not sure that we actually have one map.
Yeah, and so
per the TMDL that outlines the exact boundaries of Monterey County and City of Salinas and all the ag lands that specifically discharged all the listed water bodies. But we have those maps of those sources specifically and could easily lay them. It might exist. I'm just not sure. So, yes, we know where they are relative to each other and specifically and generally where they're discharging. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, kind of. I think we know. Do they know?
Do they know who's they and what do you
I'm
want them to?
I'm talking about the ones that we're regulating. I mean, is it clear to someone like the county of Monterey with their swamp, with their stormwater permit?
Is what clear to the county of Monterey?
What they're going to have to do in terms of, you know, implementing.
This TMDL?
Yes.
Well, you can ask the county of Monterey that, but they've been notified and involved and are implementing their stormwater program.
Okay. Is it? And it
I don't know. I don't know what they would say, but we have communicated, been communicating through the permitting process, through our permitting staff about TMDLs and the impacts of TMDLs existing and new related to their permit. And we've communicated through the TMDL outreach and development of the implementation plan to make that link.
All right. Same kind of question, I guess, for, you know, the city of Salinas would be, you know, they're not going to be some of these 303 delisted bodies are not going to be suspected areas where they might be impacting or contributing pollutants, pesticides, or toxicity, right?
I think they're well aware of our data that says where the problems are, to what extent, and how proximate, you will, to where their pollution loading enters these water bodies. And whether they are aware or not, our staff is coordinating with them to make sure that they are addressing those locations in particular and any other sources and better identifying how those two things link so that they can properly reduce their load.
Okay, well.
Maybe when they come up or their representatives, or you can ask them to answer.
Given the history of some of our interactions with some of our regulated entities. Sometimes that information exchange is not real clear, and they don't really understand perhaps what we're driving at or what we expect out of them. So that's just my observation in this, as I'm trying to sort out, you know, how the permits themselves are going to interact and cause changes in those that are being permitted.
So the specific answer to that is they will have to submit a waste load. Yeah. The stormwater entities called out in the TMDL will have to submit a waste load allocation attainment plan that will specifically tell us how they plan to implement, what is their exact plan to implement load reduction to meet the allocations that they received in these TMDLs. Mm-hmm. And that plan will include a timeline, types of management practices, and how they will monitor both for assessment or effectiveness of the actual measures as well as any water quality changes and load reduction that can be indicated by that monitoring.
Okay. With the County of Monterey's stormwater permit, what geographic area does it cover? It's not the whole county, right? It's only those areas where there's urbanization above a certain population density.
I can't draw that map in my head right now. I haven't looked at it specifically in a while, and maybe Jennifer knows. And yeah,
get us a Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy from Monterey County is actually here, so maybe he can answer that question for you.
Would you like me to answer it, or would you like Tom to? Or
what do you have the answer? Because you know we're gonna have speakers also, and I don't want to have duplication with speakers and then other questions.
I'll wait on that. I kind of assume it's a patchwork based on urban density.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
All the counties, this is Jennifer Epp, all the counties under the phase two are required to do the things in the urbanized areas as defined by the census. So right. Mr. Hardy does not have to implement his permit in 100% of the acreage of his county.
Right. And, I mean, do we have a map?
You know, yes.
In our database that actually shows that?
Yes.
Okay.
When the Phase 2 municipalities submitted their notices of intent to enroll in the permit, they provide us with a map showing us their permit coverage area.
Okay, last question has to do with labeling requirements. I heard something about, both heard and read something about the labeling requirements requiring some kind of vegetated buffer for the use of, is it just pyrethroids?
Yes, that's correct. The EPA developed, made a requirement of all the registrants, all the manufacturers of pyrethroids that register agricultural products to put label requirements, or they developed labeling for the products, which the labels are the law that the applicator has to follow, and they require implementation of buffers between fields with pyrethroid applications and down gradient aquatic habitat.
Oh, and who monitors that to see that those vegetated buffers are being installed and maintained?
Okay, well, those label requirements are all label requirements are implemented by the County Agricultural Commissioner. Well, in partnership with Department of Pesticide Regulations, they're the local agent for Department of Pesticide Regulations.
And I take it then the county ag commissioners are the ones in the field actually?
Yeah, they have a large staff of biologists that go out and regularly monitor for applications meeting label requirements. So this would be one of those components on the label. It may not be, you know, the main focus.
Is it a focus? Excuse me. Do we know if they're focusing at all on the vegetated buffer requirement when they're doing their inspections?
Yes. This UC Extension workshop that I mentioned previously, Bob Roach, the Assistant Agricultural Commissioner for Monterey County, also gave a presentation and reviewed the buffer conditions and requirements and discussed staff involvement in implementing the regulations.
What did he say?
Well, it's difficult to interpret them, and they're moving forward with further like education and staff education and developing interpretation of those regulations. So not all label language is real clear, and something in terms of aquatic habitat being defined on a label often isn't quite maybe the way we at the Water Board would define aquatic habitat. So there's a need for some clarification. Also, some farms aren't right adjacent to a water body, and the label makes it sound like those are the only ones regulated, but the farm maybe a quarter mile up gradient would be discharging through some channel to the field. So he did a nice job of explaining the complexities of the many different farm scenarios that are out there and the difficulty in trying to interpret the regulations. So that's something that we've had discussions about with DPR and the commissioner about, you know, and I think he's having ongoing discussions on how to interpret those regulations. And
is DPR contemplating clarifying the labeling requirements?
We have had some discussion and communication about that. So I don't know how much traction it's fully gotten.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Young. And I have a couple of questions, and one is actually a comment supplementing the observation that Ms. Gray made about the DPR report showing a reduction of use of pesticides. Those report on an annual basis tend to be often influenced by the weather conditions, and because we have been on a significant drought, you would expect a reduction of fungicide use and herbicide use, because if you don't have rain, you don't have weeds. So sometime, you know, these numbers go up and down, and it's in the big picture, it can have an influence. One specific example will be sulfur application, which sulfur application is way down, and that is directly attributed to the drought that has been experienced, just FYI. So, you know, conclusion should not always be direct. First question is the urban and city use examples of pyrethroids. You know, you had showed some application. One was spraying in front of a garage door, another one, you know, what appears to be a golf course. Yeah, here we go. Thank you. And Mr. Young was asking specific questions regarding to, say, Salinas and Monterey, et cetera. Can you give some specific examples of application in urban and city use, you know, since we're looking at the impact on agriculture here, but as yesterday we were discussing these other permits, do you have some examples in mind?
Excuse me, of the regulations or the use?
No, pattern? Of application. You know, we're saying this compound is being used in city and urban use. And
yes.
So my question is, all right, applied on what? Is it used,
sure,
because somebody has an ant infestation or
yes,
you,
yeah,
know, that kind of question?
Yeah, okay. Pyrethroids are... I don't have the statistics on all urban pesticide applications, but it's one of the more commonly used insecticides by professional applicators to control ants around your home.
Right.
If you were going to spray inside your house and you were to go to the garden center or a home improvement store to pick up a material to control those pests that might have an ant infestation, likely you would buy a pyrethroid pesticide. And they're also commonly used in the landscape areas, so for lawn control. And as we've mentioned before, some of the earlier pesticides that have been eliminated, and this is the class of pesticides commonly used for controlling pests around home and gardens. And so those are the major ones. When those professional companies come around, they're often applying pyrethroids.
Right. So there is, a clear educational components,
yeah,
for these regulated communities to, you know, help people understand that they shouldn't just go to, you know, their local nursery store and stock up on some of these products. You know, and you know, yesterday we had discussions about outreach and engagement, and you know, the answers were a little a little fuzzy. But I specifically asked the question here because I think it makes the point that, you know, there is a need. The pest control contractors that are used, they're regulated, and they have to have a applicator's permit, but, you know, the population at large does not. So that drives the point, I think, for the importance to help an education component. I know you discussed it a little bit, and some of my, you know, fellow board members asked the questions, but most of my other questions are going to be in further clarifying the level of engagement, you know, that you had with the, you know, stakeholders associated with this TMDL. You know, yesterday we were using letter grades for outcome, and so I definitely give you an A+ on your report. But I know there's a whole lot that's goes beyond what, you know, this thick three-ring binder covers. So I'm not trying to be repetitive of the previous questions, but I look at three aspects. You know, it's the engagement with the PCAs, you know, if you can elaborate a little about that. The next one will be, again, on DPR, because I know there's a little lonely letter feedback from them, which if one takes a cursory look, say, well, that doesn't tell us anything, but I would assume you devved a lot more into it. And then the last question I'll have, and I'll go back to the first so you don't have to memorize them, but okay, it's thanks. About the UC Davis criteria. So let's start with a PCA engagement and how much engaged were you, you know, beyond the workshop where they may be part of the audience, but has there been like some specific one-on-one meetings with PCAs or through an association?
Right. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I have been working on pesticide regulations for quite a while. And
For how long?
Well, really since I started at the Water Board almost 10 years ago, I was started in the agricultural program, and I did a lot of engagement with growers directly in the field. And I mean, to kind of step back, I have an unusual background as a Water Board employee. My background's in horticulture, not in the typical environmental science. So I, through college, took similar courses to a pest control advisors, entomology, plant pathology, and then how to apply pesticides. So the training I had at Cal Poly was to put me on track towards pest control advising and applicating, as well as being in the grower as a grower. I studied nursery management. So I have sort of a solid background in understanding a lot of the terminology, the language, and the materials. In this process, I didn't have as much on the field for this direct TMDL, did not have as much on the ground field engagement with pest control advisors. When I worked in the ag program, I had the opportunity to do some small watershed outreach, and actually some of the folks are here, Tracy Roberts I worked with. She used to be with Monterey County Farm Bureau. And we did direct engagement right in the Quail Creek watershed, going on farms and talking to growers. In Santa Maria, I did outreach and worked directly with growers and often invited the pest control advisor to come out, because it was helped to have that engagement where the pest control advisors have a lot of responsibility for agricultural crops and commodities, but they're not often engaged with irrigation or those components. So it was helpful to have that discussion where the grower understood his whole operation and the pest control advisor understood the pests and the pest thresholds and the materials. So I was able to gain a kind of a thorough understanding of their processes. But fortunately, I think UC Extension and also Abby coordinated these meetings where we were able to have good discussions with the group and not, you know, I would have enjoyed and found it valuable to have more individual discussions on field with looking at pyrethroids and their applications, but I didn't quite have that in this specific project.
So. Okay, well, thank you for the comprehensive answer, which, you know, gives me a peek on things I didn't know about you. So okay. Thank you. Now, since the PCAs are really the boots on the ground, so to speak, you know, giving the advisements, when we talked, I think it was on my left, I think it was Mayor Delgado asked a question, but, you know, about substitutions or alternatives, and the answer that you gave to the alternatives, you said, well, there are alternatives, but in some case, they may not be have the same level of efficacy and would require an additional application. So, you know, let's say then you have an alternative, and the alternative, just because of its nature, is not as effective. So you have to apply twice as often, but then, you know, what is the cumulative effect of this alternative, which by itself, single application may be, you know, benign, but if you add a second one, it has a compounding effect. So, you know, when we're looking now at alternatives, and, you know, the point made earlier, too, was, well, you know, it's like chasing the caboose, you know, of a train, because we say, no, you know, we discourage you from using A, and then, you know, the industry moved to B. So in your engagement with the PCAs, you know, currently are there some good alternatives? Which one would not have the unintended consequence of having to have increased applications? Because, you know, that's an environmental impact. And also, you know, the economic cost factor of having alternatives. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I so, yeah, we've had some discussions, and they brought up some of their concerns about alternatives. And I don't think there's a clear-cut alternative for agricultural. You know, I'm not familiar with all the materials they have available. So I would say, based on the feedback I received, that it's difficult for them to find alternatives. And while we see our agriculture here as a large industry in the scope of pesticide manufacturing, they were explaining to me that a lot of new materials don't get developed. It's a relatively small market, as opposed to, say, the urban market. Well, you've got a lot of, you know, killing, spraying for ants in California is probably similar to spraying for ants in New York. So there's a lot of similarities in, you know, market incentive. So there isn't a good market incentive. And then there were concerns about alternatives that were brought mentioned that were areas that I hadn't even considered. I mean, they sell their commodities internationally. So one advisor mentioned, he goes, well, then an alternative came on the market, but the international buyers or the countries wouldn't accept any of product that material was used on because they did not attest for residues and they didn't have protocols in place. So I think they mentioned, like, Taiwan is the reason I can't use this pesticide. I was like, oh, okay, I wouldn't have thought of that. But so they have, like, these pest control advisors have a super complex task at hand to keep these crops safe, and this is an important tool, is what they've expressed. So.
Yeah, and your point about the price is a good one, because retail price on some of these products, if you buy it by the pint in a little nursery, the markup is significantly multifold compared to if it was used for wholesale application. So there's not an economic pressure to do away with those, because that's premium price. My next question is back to the DPR engagement, and, you know, beyond that lonely letter at the end, you know, if you can elaborate a little bit more on specifically the engagement that took place with DPR staff on this process. And this process has gone on, you know, for over a year.
Oh, yeah. I would characterize that we've sort of moved beyond the TMDL, our engagement with DPR, to how do we solve the problem, how do we address it. So, I've been coordinating with Department of Pesticide Regulations for several years and for other TMDL, so I think that's maybe partially why the familiarity, we have such familiarity and specific discussions weren't incorporated into the TMDL. So we have ongoing work groups that are developing and looking at how to specifically address agricultural water quality problems. So primarily I coordinate with the Environmental Monitoring Group. They're the group that sends staff out to Santa Maria and to Salinas, and they focus and collect samples here, and they've had studies ongoing for several years. So they have engagement on the urban side, and I'm actually not that involved in that. The statewide organizations like the California Stormwater Quality Association has actively engaged Department of Pesticide Regulations and coordinates with them regularly on regulations. The urban setting, it's a little more complex. I mean, the agricultural setting is more complex, and we're taking a step-by-step approach to work with them and move forward to look at the best management practices. And they've been ongoing funding projects with researchers, and we're engaged with the County Ag Commissioner on how to move forward.
Okay, thank you. And then a question on the UC Davis criteria. You know, I saw UC Davis many pages.
Okay.
And then the mention of peer reviewed. So, I mean, are we relying on this TMDL program solely exclusively on one university's group of professors and scientists, or we have engaged a broader range, because you know the term peer review generally mean a very broad range of individuals who are not directly connected, for example, to who received a grant to do the study. So can you elaborate on that?
Oh yes, yeah. Well, on one. The UC Davis criteria was developed by UC Davis, and again, it's a different group than the group that we work with more closely in the watershed that Brian and Bryn are from. They developed a 3-phase process where first they developed criteria and a criteria methodology. Well, actually, first they reviewed existing methodology, then they developed their own methodology. In each phase of their development, they underwent peer review and had comments provided on their strategies and their approaches. Then when they actually developed the criteria report, and it's not just for pyrethroids, they started with chlorpyrifos and other more common materials that were had been regulated more commonly. And then they developed reports on each of the specific materials, and those underwent peer review. When we utilized the UC Davis criteria in the Santa Maria TMDL, we underwent extensive scientific peer review. The scientific peer review process through Cal EPA is very, very rigorous, and they would not allow anyone familiar with our project or familiar with, you know, its development to review it. So they sent our TMDL, and including that UC Davis criteria, out to reviewers throughout the country. And we had extensive, they were extensively reviewed, and comments came back on it that we addressed and UC Davis evaluated, and all in supportive of this criteria. So,
okay. Thank you for the clarification. And one last question. If we take this Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, TMDL, being proposed, how does it compare and contrast to the TMDL in other regional boards throughout the state? And then also, do we know how we compare to other states?
Well, We're a little bit on the forefront in Region 3, but not completely. There was a TMDL that was developed before we started utilizing the UC Davis criteria in the Ventura County, and it was developed by federal government, by US EPA, wrote a TMDL in that region. So the criteria has been developed with support from the Central Valley Water Board, and they have not adopted the criteria. They are proposing it as basin plan water quality objectives. The numbers would be directly written into the basin plan as objectives and not as TMDLs and or utilized as targets in a TMDL. So we are definitely at the forefront in terms of implementing and incorporating them into our planning.
Okay. Thank you very much. And, you know, what I'd like to suggest to my colleagues is we take a lunch break, then we have close to an hour and a half of public comments. If I add up all the comments, we will have opportunity, you know, to ask questions to the folks who are coming to us with comments, and then we will have a wrap-up after, you know, having reviewed all the comments and heard everyone to further, you know, refine any other questions you have. So unless you have a burning question now, I would suggest that we, you know, we take a break and then we reconvene.
I just have a brief question to you.
Sure.
Will the UC experts be present throughout the day, or do they need to leave early for some reason? Okay. All right. Thank you.
I mean, I saw a smiling face when I mentioned UC Davis. So I figured he was going to stick around. So let's, Mr. Robertson, I suggest then we take our lunch break. And how much time you suggest?
We have no closed session, so we can do an hour.
Okay, so let's make it...
Come back at 1:20.
Yes, so let's reconvene at 1:20, please. Thank you very much.